101.5 UMFM. That's right, you are tuned in to Can We Hang, where we play the best of Canadian music past, present, and future. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm your host for this week and every week. My name is Miles. Thank you for tuning in. I hope all is well. Hope you're staying safe. Hope everyone is doing good in your life. Well, we've got a very, very big show today because today I'll be airing an interview I did about maybe a couple weeks ago with the phenomenal Kim Mitchell. That's right. The great Kim Mitchell took some time to chat with me about his new single and about a whole bunch of stuff. We had a fairly interesting conversation about songwriting, about music, about life, and I'm extremely thankful for Kim for taking some time to chat. It was an incredible opportunity as somebody who spends quite a lot of time thinking about Canadian music and Canadian music only. You know, Kim Mitchell is a part of that history. I think Kim Mitchell plays a huge role in Canadian rock, and I don't think that should go unnoticed. And when I heard I had the opportunity to talk with him, I absolutely jumped at the chance. It just seemed ridiculous not to. So today we're going to be airing that interview, but we're going to play some Kim Mitchell to get you warmed up before we air the interview. So we're going to start with the new single. It's a song called Wishes. It was a song that took Kim over 10 years to write, and I can see why. It's a beautiful song. It is immaculately made. It's immaculately produced. I think he sounds fantastic on it. I think he sounds better than ever on it, and that's no exaggeration. He's an incredible singer, and it really shows on this tune. Then after that, we are going to play the big hit. That's right, we are going to play Patio Lanterns, a song I absolutely love, a song that I love to put on the car and see who responds to it. It says a lot about the people who respond to Patio Lanterns and about the people who don't respond to Patio Lanterns. And I get along well with people who respond well to Patio Lanterns. So let's start off with this. Here is Wishes by Kim Mitchell.
Some may wish for city streets, jewels or silken gown. Some may crave unbounded wealth, fame or beauty's crown. Some may long for sunny paths to lure the pleasures bent. Simpler things by far than these would keep my soul content. These are the things that I wish for. These are the things I wish for. These are the skies overhead, a tiny shack, white curtain on my sill of flower red, a laughing baby playing inside on the floor, a tiny flower garden growing outside my.
table set for supper time, fresh fruit and honeycomb, and a warm breeze that's whispering that your baby's coming home. And I'll ask no more of life. And these are the things that I'll wish for. These are the things I'll wish for. These are the things that I wish for you and me. These are the things that I'll wish for. These are the
UMFM. That was Kim Mitchell with Patio Lanterns. Before that, with Wishes. We've got our interview with Kim Mitchell coming up on the next turnaround, but we're going to play two more songs before we get the interview started. We're going to play my favorite song by the great Kim Mitchell. This song makes me laugh every single time. I think it's so much fun. It's so awesome. It is Lager and Ale, a fantastic tune. And then after that, we're going to play another song that was a big hit for the Kim Mitchell. It was a song that Mothers Against Drunk Driving took as their anthem, but it is not necessarily a song talking about the abstinence from alcohol. It is, of course, the great Go for Soda. So we're going to start off with Lager and Ale. Then you will hear Go for Soda, and then we will roll right into my interview with the great Kim Mitchell. So please enjoy. I'll hear from you next week. Stay tuned next Sunday for even more Canadian music. A great show planned for next week. So thank you for tuning in and enjoy Kim Mitchell's Lager and Ale. We'll be right back. I wanted to thank you for doing the show, honestly. I've been on hiatus lately, but when I heard I had a chance to interview you, I absolutely jumped at the chance. So thank you.
Oh, wow. Hey, well, you know, what if I make it that it's not worth your while? You're going to hang up and go, I'm self-deprecating, Craig. So I'm going to hang up and go, well, that was a waste of my time. I could have just been doing something else.
No, but I jumped at it and I thought, you know what? Kim Mitchell's the apps. That's the first guy I want to talk to. So thank you.
Oh, well, it's cool, man. Thanks. Well, nice speaking with you too.
So I wanted to ask,
are you a full-time announcer there, or are you doing the radio course, or?
Actually, I study politics.
Okay.
I always wanted to do radio. When I was like 8 years old, I heard UMFM and I thought, wow, like normal people do radio. So I just jumped at that chance, and I've been doing it for about 2 years now and have been pretty much completely obsessed with it since.
I love the way you use the word normal, because no, I want to address that just for a second, because I find normal people doing radio can be more engaging than professionals doing radio.
Well,
so I just find real people are sound real. They're not coming on like this. Hey, look out. We got five in a row. And like, it's just like, really? And you know, the radioisms of like at the top of the hour, at the bottom of the hour, you know?
I think listening to podcasts has really changed that. It's really changed the way people do radio. All of a sudden, everyone's talking really naturally instead of, you know, big personality and.
I know. When did that start and who started it? And where can we find them and poke their eyes out?
I did want to ask you, actually, you did quite a bit of radio yourself.
And I did. 11 years.
I discovered this great subset of YouTube, which is Kim Mitchell YouTube. And I watched a lot of interviews you did with guys like Alice Cooper and Slash and guys like that. Like, what goes into an interview like with that? Like, was it just another day at the office? Like, oh, Alice Cooper's coming in today. No big deal. Or is it, you know, like, is there a lot of pressure interviewing a guy like that?
Well, with Alice, there's no pressure, because Alice is the type of guy that, well, first of all, you're in radio, you're on a commercial station. So you prepare,
right?
You do your research. You have, you know, a dozen questions. Generally, I love to just sort of be conversational.
Right.
But if you have somebody who's a little difficult or whatever, you know what they're coming in to do, and they know what they're coming in to do. They're either promoting something or they're – so it's like you get that done. So you're prepared to lead that path. But with Alice, he's the kind of guy that just walks in, sits down, and starts to talk. You don't even get a question, and he just goes, he'll say hello and all that stuff. And I'll go, yeah, okay, we got a minute. And then as soon as the minute happens, you'll go, okay, that was Led Zeppelin. He goes, you know, back in the day when I was, he'll start talking about a Led Zeppelin story. So he kind of takes it.
Right.
The dude, Mick Fleetwood was my first interview in radio. And I prepared, I was really nervous, because it's like, oh my God, my first interview, but I'm a musician too. So,
right.
I think, you know, the last question I'm going to ask is, who were your influences? As soon as I hear who were your influences, or what can we expect from the show, or, you know, dare I say, you know, this one isn't too bad, but it's kind of in the same as like, well, tell us what we can expect from the show tonight.
Right.
Those tell me that you're not prepared and you're lazy. You don't really know anything about anything. Because first of all, when I get asked, who are your influences? The first thing that comes to mind is, dude, not one of your listeners gives a rat's ass about who my influences are. Nobody does. You know, you'd be better off to say it like, do you remember your first record you bought? Like there's better ways to think. And then what can we expect from the show tonight? It's like, well, let me ask you this. If I were to buy you a birthday present, say, hey, I bought you a birthday present, would you say, well, tell me what it is? It's like, well, no, I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm going to bring it over to you. Do you really want to know everything that U2 is going to be playing tonight? Well, first of all, we're going to do this. The stage is going to look like that. And boy, what do you see in that tune, we have these lasers that fire up. And all of a sudden, it's like, now I know what everything's going to happen. I don't know. I just went off on a tangent. But getting back to Mick Fleetwood, he was my first interview. And I asked him one question, and he went for like 35 minutes. We were taping. It was a phoner. And I just sat there and just went, I kept looking at my producer like, this is easy.
We should have him every day.
Yeah, yeah, sure. But he's an awesome dude, too.
Oh, absolutely.
It wasn't like, you know, boring. It was Sammy Hagar, same thing, man. He just like comes in and just starts to riff. I mean,
you can just rely on the guy like that.
Once again, and yeah, and then, you know, I remember you get sort of the talking to by handlers sometimes where, you know, the dude from the police, Andy Summers comes in from the police and he's promoting something and his handlers are like, you know, don't ask him to play anything. Cause I had guitars in the studio. So, and he goes, don't ask him to play anything, man. I'm like, okay, all right. Yeah, sure. So before he comes in, I set up the ultimate police sound, you know, the chorus guitar. And I had his sound kind of nailed almost on the gear I had. So and I went, hey man, Every Breath You Take, I said, it's really simple changes, but the way the chord inversions you play make, that's kind of what makes the song really interesting. I said, is the opening chord this? And I went, I played it and I kind of played it wrong. He goes, no, here, give me the guitar. And next thing you know, he's playing Every Breath You Take. So, you know, and as he's doing that, I'm looking out at the handlers kind of winking at him like, yeah, thanks for your feedback, guys. Anyway.
Yeah. The nice thing about, you know, doing this college radio thing is there's no handlers to deal with. I can't imagine doing an interview where you have to worry about, you know, the eyes behind the window pane watching you.
Well, you know, sometimes these major stars, I get it. It's okay.
Right.
They have a busy day. You have 6 minutes with so-and-so. You have, you know, 3 minutes with Slash. You have this.
Right.
I get it because they're like banging, bang, bang. And someone's it's their publicist who's bringing them through. But, you know, the best one was getting Jay Leno phoning me. It's like, hi, it's Kim there. Like, hello. And he goes, hi, it's Jay. I thought a handler was going to phone you. Hi, it's Jay Leno. I'm like, oh, okay. And I said, I'm Kim Mitchell. And he goes, I know who you are. Kim Mitchell, Max Webster, 1970, blah, blah. He says, I was up there doing the Draft Dodger tour. You're like one city ahead of me the whole time.
Wow.
Yeah. So we just kind of got along and same thing with Bob Saget. He's like, man, I opened up for you guys in Ballow, you know, when I was like, really? why don't I remember this? He goes, you weren't at the game. I opened up the show.
So I will ask one generic question. I'm sure it's a question you've gotten 100 times in the past.
I'll give you a generic answer.
That's fine. You know what? Listening to your music. The big thing I get is the size of your music. It sounds like something that should fill an arena or, you know, fill a festival. But obviously, we're not going to get a lot of festivals for a while. We're probably not going to get a lot of arena concerts for a while with COVID-19 happening. So the question is, how has COVID-19 affected sort of the new album coming out? Has it affected it at all? Was there any tour planned that had to be canceled? You know, how much was thrown in the trash with this happening?
That's a good question. It was all thrown in the trash. The manual as to what we would be doing, the itinerary was ripped up and thrown in the trash. I had gigs booked for this summer that were coming up and there was more stuff filling in by the week. So it was kind of right around when it hits. That's kind of when your summer dates are flowing in. And as far as touring goes, just don't know.
Right.
Don't know when that's going to happen. I'm certainly not going to get on an airplane until it's safe to do so. And I wouldn't want to endanger anyone in my audience.
Right.
But I'm kind of looking towards the premieres and stuff when I think each province's premier, at least ours, sort of has his finger on the pulse as to how to open and keeping a close eye on it all and being cautious. I think generally Canadians are being quite cautious on the whole. I still go into a grocery store and you know, I'll wear a mask because we've been mandated to do so. And I'll sanitize my hands as soon as I get out and stuff. So that's can only go so far. I'm not going to, you know, crawl under a rock and stay there until there's a vaccine or something.
Right.
We're social beings. We need to pick a few people around us that are safe to be around. And I think we're adapting quite well. So anyway, to your point, yeah, touring is off until further notice. I know Live Nation, they've moved everything to 21. So we'll see, but who's to say that that is going to happen, but hopefully it will. And as far as the album, it was done, and we, in a perfect world, we would have been able to play, release a track and get out and play it. We can't. So the question was, do you want to still release it? Do you want to hold it? So we held it for a little bit, and then I went, no, let's put out Wishes, because it's kind of relevant, even though the song was written well before COVID. And it kind of has a nice message. And
It has a really great message of hope, which I really like about it. You know, it's a beautiful song. You know, and it's so well performed. I think you're right.
Thanks, Miles.
I think it really did come at the right time, at least for me. You know, I thoroughly enjoy that song.
Thank you.
And it was the right climate, sitting at home, you know, sort of reflecting with that song.
Yeah. Well, thank you, first of all, Miles. And the feedback so far has been over the top. I wasn't really expecting that. Of course, as a musician, I don't expect anything. The journey for me is writing it and recording it. After that, I only hope that the people hear it will like what they're hearing. That's all. So thanks for that. And yeah, it was finished, as I say, before COVID. It was a 10-year write. I found those lyrics 10 years ago. It kind of is relevant today. Just, you know, we can wish for this and we can wish for that. You know, beauties, crown, wealth, city streets, whatever you wish for, that's fine. But over here, there's some simpler things too that give us just as much, fill us with everything we need. And hopefully you get some of those before we die. So it's kind of, yeah. It is simple, but it's beautifully written. And I'm not saying I wrote, you know, it's a poem that I wrote that from. So
right.
I loved the poem 10 years ago, you know, and I think that the song sort of found me. It was floating around and went 10 years ago, as opposed to me reaching over and picking up a Reader's Digest. The song sort of came through me and went, you're going to be the conduit to write this. So pick up that book of poetry as opposed to the outdated Reader's Digest. And there's a poem you're going to open up right now. Open it up. There's a poem, read that. And that's me. I want to come to life. So you're the musician I've picked to write that tune. I know that sounds kind of cosmic and stupid, but most musicians are like, yeah, I came up with this part. And then I came up with that part. Yeah. A few months later. And then, you know, here I am now sitting in my $20 million house, but it was more that song found me. So I worked for it. I felt like it's roadie.
It makes me think of, there's a great Bob Dylan interview where somebody asks him how he wrote all those songs. And he just says, I didn't write any of those songs. Those songs just sort of came to me. They just kind of came out of me. I was just sort of, you know, something to be channeled through. I wasn't the one writing those songs.
I love that he said that, because I feel like that.
Yeah.
Because people are like, well, where do you get the ideas? I haven't heard one musician go, well, you know, I opened up the fridge one day and the idea was, you know, sitting in the loaf of bread there. You know, it's like, I don't know. We don't know where these come from. It really is something divine where they're floating around in the universe and they go, and all of a sudden this idea is wanting to be developed. It's like, come on, here's the riff. Go. You're trained to do this.
Actually, I wanted to ask you, this past couple of years, I've had a chance to, I play in my dad's Legion band. So we play a lot of, you know, 50s music, the golden oldies. And,
what do you play?
I play drums.
Oh, cool.
I also play a little bit of guitar. I've got my, I got a couple of guitars right behind me at the moment. So, but you know, playing with my dad, it's given me a chance to, you know, experience sort of the seedier side of Winnipeg, and that's spending a lot of time in Winnipeg bars. I wanted to ask you, do you have any particularly notable bars that you think, like, that was a great show, like, great club, great place, and is there any other place that sort of strikes you as, oh man, that was one of the seedier joints?
Well, I've cut my, you know, I think every musician cuts his teeth, his or her teeth in those places. You start off playing bars, and I certainly did too. Actually, I find, and I don't mean I'm not talking seedy, some of my best bar gigs have been in Winnipeg.
Really?
There's a couple great rock bars. Yeah, a couple great rock bars I've played there. And I'm trying to think of the name of it. For some reason, it's just at this very moment that I'm trying to remember it, it's slipping through my memory. My road manager remembers everything. I go, what's the bar we play in Winnipeg? And he go, oh, it's blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, that's it. Okay. But I can picture it. The motel is attached to it. The hotel, there's a restaurant, but sort of buffet style restaurant. And yeah, we had some good rocks in Winnipeg. Casino there as well.
Oh, it's on, awesome. It's on the tip of my tongue as well.
But seedy bars where people are kind of dangerous and people are kind of, yeah, we've all done them.
For sure.
I think the cool thing about it though is if you're playing rock and roll, you're playing it below the belt and people are just going to dig it.
Right. Right.
You know, they just might get a little demanding, like, play this.
You know,
we don't know it. Well, you better learn it now. That kind of thing. I don't know. That's all okay, which is cool.
I really enjoy watching you perform because, you know, it never feels like you're throwing in the towel. You really look like you still love being on stage and performing.
Oh, yeah.
Is that the thrill these days? Is it getting on stage and playing those songs?
Miles, it always has been that.
Right.
Writing and recording is part of the career too, but the thing you're working towards all the time is that walking on a stage, whether it's in front of 400 people, 4,000, or 20,000 people, it's walking on stage with a band that inspires you, and you start to play and you start to connect and transmit a musical energy between you. That to me is the payoff. That is like, wow, this just feels so good. And I've told young musicians, like, oh yeah, I got a band we just play in the garage on weekends and jam, and we'd love to get out and do some stuff. Okay, look man, if you're in your garage with a case of beer or whatever playing for four of your friends, and when you connect, when you have that moment of connection, when you're playing your tunes in the garage, that's that energy you're transmitting. That's the same thing that AC/DC, a Celine Dion, a Bryan Adams, a Rush, Kim Mitchell, whoever, that's the exact same feeling that we're all feeling. Right. It's that feeling like, oh yeah, this feels great, man. Oh man, that was good. And the only difference is then at the end of the night, the numbers are different.
Right. Right. How do you feel getting off stage these days? I don't mean to insult genuinely, but like there is a lot of acrobatics on stage and you know, once you get off stage.
Not for me. No, not really. Yeah. I think you must be imagining I'm doing a lot of acrobatics. There aren't anymore.
Right.
I'm an older dude, and I think the past 5, 6, 7 years, I mean, there's a bit of running over to this part or whatever if the mood hits me, but it's not like the late 70s and 80s when I was jumping around like an idiot and leaping, and you just can't do that anymore.
Right.
Like physically can't do that anymore. It's like the conversation between singer Paul Rogers, who used to be in Bad Company, and Robert Plant, Led Zeppelin. Paul Rogers says, "Rob, man, this past year I'm like trying to hit some of those high notes I used to do, and I can't hit them anymore." Robert Plant says, "You're not supposed to." Yeah. So not supposed to anymore. And another thing is, you know, as time rolls on, and that great Robert Plant quote where someone went, "So come on, like one more Led Zeppelin tour." And he's like, "Tour? Led Zeppelin tour?" He goes, "Man, in 2 years, I'm going to need help walking across the street." So,
yeah, I think that's the right way of taking it. You know, just knowing, you know, that was in the past and, you know, we're moving on. I respect that.
Yeah. And because of that, the world, their world opens up to new,
absolutely,
the new world, a younger generation, a whole nother generation comes in. And that's, people are like, "Well, what do you think of the music of today?" It's like, "Well, it's, how has it changed?" I said, "Well, it's supposed to change. Every generation, right, brings their message to music, speaks their own language, says it in the own, their own way." I said, "That's a beautiful thing. I may not buy this record or that record or dig that, but I respect and dig the fact that this is happening. Mm. This is real. And it's their way of saying it and communicating with their audience." And it's lovely, because that's what they did in the 50s. You're saying you played with your dad. That's what they did in the 50s. Right. And then in the 60s and 70s, it was a kind of a different generation. And then in the 90s, a whole different thing started. Now in, you know, 2020, it's like a whole different thing again. It's beautiful watching this all change.
Well, I actually wanted to ask you, you know, putting out a new single and putting out a new record, you know, we sort of live in sort of, you know, the post-physical music world. Does any part of you sort of pine over the days of, you know, in the good old days we used to put out records and people would go come out and buy the vinyl? Or is it just, it, do you also see that as a natural progression?
People still buy vinyl.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Younger generations still buy vinyl. I'm not sure really what you've asked me there, Miles, but music is recorded different, music is written different, music is consumed different, and that's fine. That's all cool. I'm happy and grateful that there's still a stage once in a while for me. And in the past, I'm going to say past 5 years of performing, the attendance has been great. It's you know, so whatever I'm doing, there's still a little bit of an audience, right, for it. I'm grateful for that. But I know, you know, I'm never going to be like a disc jockey, like a DJ who goes out and there's 30,000 people and he's standing up there, he or she's standing up there with some gear playing records.
Right. You know?
And people are losing their mind. But that's exactly what I'm talking about. That may be something where I scratch my head, but it's like, it's a beautiful thing at the same time, right, to me. I'm like, every generation digs what they dig, and it's, they relate to, yeah, you know, I'm getting
the important thing is that making a connection, you know, it doesn't matter what you're
exactly
doing on stage. It's just about connecting with the audience. And if you can do that, yep, that's all that matters.
Yep. It's transmitting an energy and it's connecting. Yep. Well put. Man.
I did want to ask, in a lot of the promo photos I see of you, I see you playing a Fender Strat. So as a little bit of a guitar nerd, I will ask, is the Strat still the guitar of choice? Is that still, you know, the first guitar you reach to?
Yeah, it's, I'm not sure what picture you're referring to, but yeah, my guitars are pretty much all Strat style bodies, except for I do own a Les Paul.
Right.
Which I love to. I use it. It's on the new record, actually, in a couple tunes, and not in a Les Paul rock way. It's in a more atmospheric way. It was quite nice for that. And it was just randomly, I picked it up,
right,
to try it, and the part worked. You know, you pick up things that you just, oh, I'll try this, I'll try that when you're recording. But yeah, it's always a Strat style thing. And I like, and what I love about Strats are two things. I like the noise and the clacking and the little squawks and squeaks that Stratocasters,
right,
make. I love the dynamics of them. I love the glossiness of them. But what I love the most about them is when they go out of tune in a real beautiful way.
Really?
Those, yeah. If I may indulge with just a short little story. When I was young, I played in a band in Sarnia, Ontario. And we opened up for a band called the MC5 out of Detroit. And we all shared the same dressing room. Yeah, I told this story to Little Steven, and Little Steven went, "Whoa, stop." He goes, "Did you just say you opened up for the MC5? And I went, "Yeah." He goes, "Man," he goes, "your cred just went way up in my eyes."
I'm still reeling from it. That's awesome.
Yeah, man. Well, so anyway, so Brother Wayne Kramer is in the dressing room. We're all in the same dressing room. And I think it's Ann Arbor we're playing. Ann Arbor, somewhere around there, Ann Arbor, Michigan. And the National Guard is surrounding the perimeter of this huge concert facility. Right. And I'm talking to Brother Wayne Kramer, and I thought he's just going to say, "Go away, little kid from Sarnia." And I went, "Hi." I said, "I see you changing the strings on your Strat." I said, how many shows do you get through?" And he goes, "I change them every show." And I went, "Oh, okay." And then I didn't really have anything else to say, and I walk away. But here's the point I'm getting at. I said, "Why is there a reason why you do that?" He goes, "Well, first of all," he says, "I'll break them after by second show," he says, "because I beat the living piss out of the guitar every night." So I'm like, "Okay," and I haven't seen him play yet. So all of a sudden he gets up there, and he's like, windmills and just hacking the daylights of it. By the third song, it was really kind of out of what we would say out of tune. Like it was, the G was wonky, the D was weird, the low E. And I remember being a little kid going, "I can love the sound of that guitar out of tune right now." It's like, normally I like things in tune. Like as a musician, it's the first thing you do. You learn how to tune a guitar. But I'm like, this sounds beautiful right now. Like it sounded bigger. And so only a Stratocaster can do that. A Stratocaster can be out of tune and sound beautiful to me. Does that make any sense? Am I weird? I guess I am.
I think it makes sense, and I also think it's weird. I think that's, you know, the beauty of it, really.
I'm so
I think
anti.
It could be both.
Yeah, I'm so antique. Like, if a classical musician ever heard me talk like that, they'd just walk past me on the street. Well, you know what? There's something beautiful about that. Yeah, there really is.
There's beauty in chaos, and there's nothing more chaotic than a guitar wildly out of tune.
Especially in the MC5. While he's playing the song, Kick Out the Jams, you know? Like, get down.
But, you know, you don't want to hear Kick Out the Jams and it be performed perfectly. Like, you want to hear them bash that song out. You want to hear some destruction when you hear Kick Out the Jams.
You do. That's the essence of rock and roll. You don't want to hear it auto-tuned.
Absolutely.
You don't want to hear everything in tune. You don't want to hear it on the grid. You don't want to... It's got a, you know, there's some bands that know that and respect that. Rival Sons is one of them. They're one of my favorite bands. It's just like, they sound like one of those one take. All right, ready? Ready to go? Okay, turn on the tape. Ready? Roll the machine. Okay, here we go. Bang, into the song. It's like, cool. And maybe the engineer or producer goes, "You want to do another one?" They're like, they look around the room, go, "Was that good?" Yeah. And they go, "Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, no, we're good. That was the take." Like, I love that. You know, yeah, they would maybe. I mean, Mr. Buchanan, I don't think sings out of key very often, but maybe you miss a note here and there. Like, who cares? Like, fully.
That's the charm. That's the charm. But when, like, especially on this new record, you know, what's your process for recording? Is it how much is live? How much is?
It's all played live. It's not. There's nothing.
Right.
There's very little. There's very little machinery on it. There's a couple keyboard sequences that are kind of mixed down just to sort of enhance a pulse that I wanted. But other than that, we went down Los Angeles and the drums and guitar and bass. Greg Wells, my producer, he's such an amazing musician. He played drums and bass. So yeah, he'd cut the drums and I'd be there playing away. And then he'd throw the bass on. And then a lot of the times I wanted to make sure we got a lot done with my time in Los Angeles. So I wouldn't finish the song there. So I came home and I'm set up at home to go, okay. I'd roll the thing, bass and drums, and just rock out on the guitar one or two takes. And that would be it. and then, you know, sing it. Same kind of thing. That's what I love about today's technology, Miles, is I really believe in the theory that you're going to grab your best performance in the first couple takes. You know, one, you'll have some magic moments, but you might, your throat's clearing or you're adjusting something. But with today's technology and recording at home, you can do your one or two takes for a couple weeks, you know?
Right.
They can go back downstairs 2-3 days from now and go, I'm going to do a couple more. Bang, bang, bang. Okay, there. Go. I'm going to go walk the dog now. A couple more days go by. Oh, I'm going to do a couple more takes. Bang, bang, bang. And then you go back and you listen to all of them. You go, there's the one. Or the front half of that one and the back half of that one. There's the take.
Right. All of a sudden, it's almost like with modern technology, it's free from the pressure of, all right, you know, we've got 8 hours and we have to get a perfect vocal take.
You're exactly right.
And let's go for it.
Yep. Because time was money back then. You know, you're in a studio and it's costing you money. And there's a nice, beautiful pressure about that too, because you, okay, that's it. It's only 24 tracks and we've used them and there's the song.
Right. Well, I know this record for you took a little longer than, you know, past records had taken. It had taken 13 years almost.
Well,
was that partly the reason?
Writing it took that time. The actual process took, I'm going to say, a couple of years. Just because Greg Wells, my producer, was a busy, busy dude. So it'd be like, I have a week coming up. Do you want to come down to Los Angeles? Be like, yeah, I'll be there. So we'd work for a week and then I might not get the call for, you know, a few months again or 6 months later. It's like, okay, I have another week. Let's go. And then I don't know, man. I'm doing the Greatest Showman soundtrack. I don't know when I'm going to. So I go, you know what? I'm in no hurry, Greg. I'll wait till you're available because you're producing this and I love what we're doing together. So I'll just wait till you're available. And that's kind of most of the reason why it took so long. Once the stuff was down, I came home and finished it up pretty quick.
Right. So I just have a couple more questions, just sort of wrapping up. I wanted to ask, how much of your life is spent with music these days? You know, like, is it still, is it a hobby for you, or is it, you know, is it still the undying passion, or has it always been, and will it always be?
Great question. I have other things that I do. I'm just like everyone else. I have a dog. I have friends. I have a life that I like to just hang out and not be Kim Mitchell. I'm just Kim. I have family. I have two sons. And so there's a lot more of that. But when I do step into that other room, I'm totally still full of passion. Like, it's really more so than ever, probably. It means so much more to me than it did when I was a young dude. Now, I make the joke that big Alex Lifeson and I were sitting around and went, Alex, when you got into this, did you get it for the chicks? And he was like, yeah. Like, we both agreed that, you know, as a young dude, it's like, yeah, it was like to get, you know, chicks, like, they think guitar players are cool. So yeah, that's why I said. And then, you know, that goes away and he got married. And so all that's left now is the music. So you might as well enjoy it. Making light of something. But I guess I'm just saying, I really do savor when I do walk into music. It just is not all consuming. Like when I was younger, it's 24/7. Right, although I have to say, and you probably know this, when you're preparing for a gig or when you're writing or recording, it is all consuming. You wake up in the middle of the night and you go, I gotta make sure tomorrow I fix that, or, you know, I practice that, or, you know, oh, I gotta make sure I listen to that. I think I can do that better. You know, there's a little bit of that stuff too.
Do you find that you can enjoy music now more without that sort of 24/7 pressure?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it was my producer, Greg Wells, taught me a little bit about that. I think right. he said a big mistake bands make when they're recording is they, you know, musicians, they might start working on something and they'll just keep working on it for, they might start working on it at 11 in the afternoon. And by 2 in the morning, they're still, you know, working away. He says, we're going to work from 11 in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. And then you're going away. You're going back to your hotel and you're going to go for dinner and you're going to walk around Culver City and enjoy California. And tomorrow it's a new day. And believe it or not, we'll make a better record because of that. Because he's done it for 20 years and he was right. You come back into the studio and your brain's fresh. You're listening to everything fresh. You haven't burned out. So I'm not sure if that's what you're asking me, but
yeah, it's having a bit more of that balance rather than, you know, like we said earlier, you know, I've got this amount of time. All right, here we go.
And let's, you know why, Miles? You know why you need that balance? Is because life itself is your inspiration for your music.
Absolutely.
It's not Absolutely. Always, it's not always another song. It's not always that. It's like what is happening to you in your life with your relationships with people. And that's the stuff that somehow magically turns into these, you know, these, the output, which is your music.
I found, you know, I've written a couple songs myself and, you know, there was nice. A point where I had to take a step away from it because I found myself trying to go back to the well and sort of, okay, I got to keep writing. But the thing I found is, you know, I've got to go out and, you know, see a few things and, you know, live around the world a little bit before I can come back and attempt to write more because, you know, there's only so much inspiration you can get from these small amount of stories.
That's a bang on point that you just made. You can't force creativity. Like you can't go downstairs. Right. I mean, there are people who are hired to do that. Session musicians, people who are writing jingles, commercials and stuff. We got to write a commercial today for such and such. And then at 2, we're writing another one. There's writers, staff writers that do that stuff. They're trained to come up with, okay, this and this. But for a band and your own creative music, you can't hurry that. And you do have to live life. Case in point, and I'm not going to name any names, but some younger female singers that I've heard, they're talented as all get out. And then a buddy of mine went, because I'd be like, ah, listen to this. And she's like so talented. She's just so amazing. It's like, and he goes, yep, she's going to be amazing. I'm like, what? She already is. He goes, no. He says, go listen to Bonnie Raitt right now. And there's somebody who's really lived a lot of life and been through the ringer, because you sort of just touched on that. Life itself brings a lot of mojo. And sometimes I find you can be textbook smart. You can be technically amazing. I look on Instagram and see guitar players that they're barely 20 and they're playing circles around so many people. It's just like, how have you become this proficient on your instrument at that age? And yet, when you think about all I can think about, and I think about this in pause, I don't sit there and go, well, you're missing this. I think I can't wait to hear you 20 years from now when you've lived so much more of life. You know?
And that's the sign of a truly great musician. When you hear them at a young age and think, you know, they're good now, but you know, 4 records from now, 5 records from now, you know, that's really going to be their peak.
A decade.
You can just tell.
Records, like a decade. You know, I want to see what you're doing on Instagram a decade from now, if Instagram even exists then, because it's like you will have love and lost. You will have, you know, life will have kicked you in the crotch some, and you know, there'll be a lot more mojo in your playing, more than there is now.